This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury. Temporarily today, I'm in Orlando, Florida. And here with me is Liz McGee. Liz, hi.
Hi, Lon.
You're still in Denver. You haven't made it down here yet.
Nope, I won't be until tomorrow.
Okay, well, I'll probably see you there. I'm going over tomorrow and starting to do a little bit of circulating. Well, this is the Woodbury Report, and today we're going to talk about some of the news items that have been happening in the network of private parent choice residential schools and programs for struggling teens. And there's a number of things that have been happening, and so what we'll do is Liz and I will talk about them and then play an interview with a person on that. Now, those of you that are listening live, on the lower right-hand side is a chat function. If you click on that, you'll be able to answer, ask questions, make comments as we go, and so please feel free to use that. We'll try to get to them as we go through this. Now, the first thing we're going to talk about is digital addiction, and that's something that all of the programs and many of the public schools are dealing with, where kids just lose themselves in games or Facebook or all the digital things to where it's probably rechanging and rewiring the brains of it. So Hillary Cash was interviewed Monday Today, Maria Shriver's program about one of their graduates, and she runs probably the first program, residential program for young men that deals with digital addiction and treats it. So she talks about that. So I presume you see some of that in your activities too.
Liz? You know, yeah, even in the, you know, we work at Sandhill Child Development Center. We work with the younger kids, but you would be surprised at even the 9 and 10-year-olds that we see that appear to be just completely hooked on whether it's the iPad, video games. I think for a lot of parents, it's sometimes just a battle they don't want to fight, and they just find that the kids get really hooked into this, and literally when they come to us, you can see how anxious they are without their electronics. And so it's definitely something I think that we're going to be seeing at a younger and younger age.
Yeah, and it's something they have to deal with. I have a grandson that we came to live with us here a while back for a year and a half, and he came down, his eyes would light up and he'd get enthused only when you're talking about Call of Duty or Halo or World of Warcraft or one of those type of violent video games. And I think it rewires the brain. There's a lot of studies are showing it's rewiring the brain, and they're predicting this generation will probably think differently. Their brains will operate differently. So we need to make sure we get this right, because it's with us.
And I think the program that Hillary is with, I think she's one of the co-founders or maybe the founder of that program. But I think that what's interesting is that's one of the programs that's really solely focused on that. I know there are some other up and coming ones, but I know that Restart, where she works, has been around for a while and has quite a very good reputation.
Yeah, I think they've been around 3 or 4 years, maybe mm-hmm. a little longer. And then she'd been doing counseling for some time. But yeah, she is the founder or co-founder, mm-hmm. but I think she was the impetus for it. Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to what Hillary has to say when I interviewed her, and then we can talk about what she says a little bit more. Welcome to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury in North Idaho, and here is where we talk with professionals who work with struggling teens and what the things that they're doing that are newsworthy. So today I have on the line Hillary Cash from Falls City outside of Seattle, and she's the founder of Restart, a program on internet-type addictions. And so, Hillary, glad to have you here.
Thanks, Lon. I'm happy to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about Restart. How long have you been operating, and what do you do? You work with young adults, I believe. Is it co-ed? Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. We opened up over 5 years ago in 2009. We were open for men and women both at that time. We are now for men only. There were very, very few women who came. And the idea was to get them away from the internet long enough for them to detox, you know, for their brains to go through that change that allows it to function normally, to support them while they develop what we call the life balance plan, which is quite a lengthy document and one in which they have to really think through how they're going to reintegrate computers in a healthy way back into their lives. And give them skills that they generally and usually were lacking. So those continue to be our goals as we are now in our sixth year. One of the things we recognized was that we really needed a second phase of the program to give those who were appropriate a more prolonged period of abstinence or near abstinence. While they tried to implement those plans that they'd created. So we do have a phase two as well.
About how long does the, and I understand they're mostly in the 20s, millennials type of thing, aren't they? But how long is your program average?
Yes, well, first of all, these are 18 to 28-year-olds for the most part. Now, we have had people in their 30s and 40s as well, but just not many. And then what was the question again?
The question was involved with how long the program is. Well, that was part
okay,
of the question.
Okay, right. So they stay with us in that first phase for 45 to 90 days, and the average length of stay, I would say, is around 8 weeks, and some are there actually longer than 90 days. But for the most part, it's 8 to 12 weeks in that first phase. And then if they go into the second phase, we have them sign leases. We set them, help them sign leases, get set up in apartments, in one large apartment complex where they all have their apartments. And those leases are 6 months. So they're pretty much committed to staying in phase two for 6 months or longer. They can, and some do, leave earlier, and then they have to break the lease.
Okay, well, the proof of the pudding is the alumni and how it's done. And about a week or two ago, one of your graduates was interviewed by Maria Shriver on the Today Show, which got a lot of notice around the country. And so how did that go? Did you know that it was happening and been talking to that graduate? And what sort of response did you get?
Well, the response was great. We got a lot of calls and continue to get calls from people who saw that and must have made a note on it because it's been a couple of weeks now and people are still contacting us because of it. It has been, this young man is doing fabulously well and he's back in college and has actually started, he's replicated the 12-step program that we started for our folks here called ITAA, and so he started an ITAA at his college, and his parents have said he's doing extremely well. He seems to be happy, being very physically active, active with his music. You know, he's just doing great.
Well, he sure looked great on there, and it was sort of scary when he was describing
what he was doing and where he was at. And it sounds like he was really in deep trouble, so he really needed something like your program. So what are your plans for the future? Are you going to expand? About how many do you have now? Are you looking to expand that in any way? What's the future look for you?
Yeah, well, we are limited in our size right now. We really, on average, are having just 5 or 6 people at a time there. But we are looking around for a larger facility, and we actually already tried to purchase 2, but for various reasons, those did not pan out. So we know we need to expand. We want to expand. You know, we're maintaining a waiting list, and it's a shame to have people having to wait. So that is one of the things, and eventually I think we are going to open an adolescent program as well. So we're looking forward to those things, looking around for land to build or a facility to purchase in this area. And I don't quite know when all that will happen, but we're looking forward to it when it can.
Well, when it's time, yeah, I'm sure it'll happen. Are you going to go back to offering this for young women? Because I know guys generally have the problem, but more and more girls are starting to get involved and running into problems on it too, I understand. So are you going to be opening it to women at some point?
Well, that is in our long-term plans. We would like to have a separate facility for women. I think we're not going to go co-ed, probably. Although, who knows? We'll see as it plays out. But yes, we are getting more and more calls. I'm noticing just in this last year, actually. And so there is a need there, and we will eventually, I hope, be able to address it.
And it's expanding, an expanding need, I'm sure, from what I read in the papers. And, of course, being on national TV is just going to let more people know that there is some help. And I'm sure the future looks bright. I think you're in the beginning of something that is very, very a growing problem in our society that's going to need more services than are being offered now.
Yes, I am. I do know that that's true. I've been watching this sort of develop over the last 20 years, and it's certainly not going away.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you, Hillary. Thank you very much. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, and we've been talking to Hillary Cash about the restart that she founded, dealing with young males, primarily young males, adult males, that have computer type or digital interdictions. Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you so much, Lon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, I know the area. I've driven past it. I haven't had a chance to visit the program in Falls City. It's very rural. So part of the treatment is just getting out in nature, a lot of trees and grass, and away from all the distractions and the program there. And that seems to be a key part of it, along with counseling and therapy and things like that.
I think that makes sense. I just think this is such an interesting area because if you think about the struggle that treating these problems, it's really a struggle because you really have to work with these people in finding a balance because, you know, really it would be very difficult for them to abstain from technology and maybe while, you know, some of them are just addicted to games, it seems games or, you know, internet or whatever that their focus might be, other things I would imagine could trigger it. So, you know, having to find a balance because really technology is a part of our lives, our everyday lives. I mean, you and I are using it right now. We're expecting people who hear this show to, you know, be using it. So I think it's really interesting and quite a challenge to try to find that balance for them.
You know, there's a bunch of questions here, and one of them, is this being treated as an addiction? And yes. Mm-hmm. It's specifically an addiction of... I've seen several articles in some play, it's not really an addiction, but it's an addiction in that you lose yourself and you can't control yourself. And they say that one of the reasons for substance abuse addiction is that it rewires the brain. Well, the studies are showing that too much computer involvement also rewires the brain in a very similar way. So the answer to that is, yes, it's generally considered as an addiction, and there people are being treated for gaming or other things. I imagine girls have a tendency to get on Facebook. We all know that computers and the internet tends to be a time suck. You get on then Facebook to check you know, spend a minute or two, and a half hour to an hour is gone. Mm-hmm. And let's see, is this really an issue? It's becoming an issue. And how bad do people get with this? Well, there's one kid that at least that I heard of that died because he was so addicted to computer games that he would put a catheter on, wouldn't get up to go to the bathroom, didn't eat. I think he starved himself to death.
Wow.
That's getting really bad. And so it is an issue. And now the question of expanding to other locations, well, she talked about in the... In the future, hopefully expanding it and probably other locations. There are some other startup programs. And how do you recognize there's a problem like anything else when normal life disappears?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens.
Yeah, and I again, you know, we're seeing this. You know, she said they're considering opening a program for adolescents, and I'm sure I know there are programs out there right now that are dealing with this with adolescents because that's, you know, usually, like I said, it starts for the kids that we see even younger than adolescents. So it's something that's usually in place for quite some time and I think is really starting to significantly disrupt lives earlier and earlier in their lives. So I'm glad to hear that they're going to be focusing on adolescents.
Yeah, I think that's good. They need it. And it sort of reminds me of... excuse me, I got a bit of a frog in the throat. So it reminds me of a cartoon I saw. It says, The Apocalypse. And then it shows a whole group of kids walking to school, everybody bent over with their smartphones or their tablet, and texting to each other. Mm-hmm. And there's the example of kids sitting at the table, and they don't know how to talk. Instead, they text to each other.
And I think that's actually a really legitimate, you know, concern. I mean, kids aren't really testing things out as much with their peers. There's a lot of texting going on. There's a lot of emailing going on, Facebooking going on. And, you know, when you're doing that, you're not sitting in front of a person, looking at their facial expressions, the cues that they're giving off, learning, you know, what's necessarily socially appropriate and not based on what's going on in the environment. You're really, you know, making certain assumptions based on what's being written or being shown to you, but you're really not interacting with that other person that really does help develop those ability to pick up on those, you know, psychosocial cues. So I think it has far-reaching implications.
Yeah, and we're just beginning into that, now on the question, yes, it's a legitimate thing. It's extreme we're talking about. Some kids get into it and it gets a time suck, and we all have a problem with that. But you can still have a life. You can go out, and I see studies. Most of the kids, they use it a lot, but they use it to supplement their normal socializing. So it isn't as bad. Let's go on to the next one, the next clip. Character education is something that therapeutic boarding schools have been emphasizing for some time, and then values, and teach the proper values like honesty and consistency, and things that kids have lost sight of when they need a therapeutic boarding school or wilderness therapy. So we have Marianne Campbell with Home School back in Connecticut, and they have very specifically, an important part of their curriculum has been character education, and she describes some of what they do. But a lot of that applies as she was describing, and I was thinking, well, gee, when I was working with Rocky Mountain Academy, that's what, you know, some of the things they were teaching, and I'm sure you've seen that in Liz, in a lot of schools.
Absolutely. I think that's a core part of a number of schools, whether they're therapeutic in nature or not.
Yeah, a lot of the mainstream boarding schools or public schools even are getting into some of that teaching character. But they're doing it by integrating it into the curriculum, not doing a class. I think the mistake a lot of places do is, well, we'll have a class in character education and teach values. Well, you got to live it. And I think Marianne Campbell, she's the executive director of Glen Holm, and she talks about that. So let's see what Marianne Campbell says, how they're approached character education, and then we can discuss it a little bit more.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury in North Idaho. And today we're going to talk about character education. Actually, character education in practice, I hope. And I have on the line Marianne Campbell. She's the executive director of Glen Holm School in Connecticut. And hi, welcome. Glad to have you here, Marianne.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Okay, well, once over lightly is about all the time we have. But... as you understand it, just what is character education? It's been bandied around a lot in the last several years. But what is character education as you understand it?
As I understand it and how I utilize it here at the school is twofold. One is it's a common language. We've identified what our values are and we've defined them. Once they're defined, we use it as an education tool and a decision-making tool so that when kids are faced with decisions that they're not sure whether to follow the pack, you know, to resist peer pressure, or deciding to do something, often young people do things impulsively. And so our program is really designed for them to look at, is it the right thing to do? What would it be like if everyone did it? Is it respectful? Is it fair? Am I being trustworthy or honest about it? So those are the ways in which we teach the students on their decision-making model, whether it's something they're going to do on Facebook or something that they're going to do in class or something three or four students may get together and decide that they would like to do things. These are the kinds of things that we ask them to address when they're making decisions. Okay. Now, we've also... Go ahead.
Yeah, let me a little bit. Now, you work with a rather unique population. You're known as a therapeutic boarding school, and you work with kids with learning differences.
Yes, we do.
Okay, so mm-hmm. I would imagine when they first come there, and you're talking about character education or doing the right thing, which is what I gathered from what you said, some of them resist, or how do they take to that? Do they know what you're talking about?
Well, sometimes they don't. The first line of action that we took in 1995, this is how long we've been doing it, is teaching the adults. And the adults had to learn about this and agree to it and be a part of the educational model. They had to be the role model. They had to use the vernacular. They had to define it in classes. They had to because we are a boarding school, so it had to be defined in the living environment, in the food service when they go down to the dining hall for meals. The food service staff had to know about it. So everyone here was educated on the entire program, how to deliver it. And then the students started to make the transition. We made the transition a number of different ways. We made it fun. We made movies. We did acts of kindness. We gave out honesty and caring awards. We filmed little vignettes that the kids could participate on what it was like. We had Tom Selleck come here when we were part of Character Counts back in the 90s, and we had gone to the Bushnell Theater, and we brought in kids from all over the state of Connecticut who had performed some level of acts of kindness, and we gave them these great awards. So we really tried to make it a very universally understood. These are not words that are hard to understand. We really worked very hard in our community in the state of Connecticut to bring character education to the table.
Sounds like you made it the cool thing to do in your environment.
Well, guess what you have to do with kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the first hurdle then from what you said, I gather, is that the adults, the staff members, you had to get all the staff members on board first to really understand what I was talking about. Were there problems there where some people just didn't get it or didn't agree, or did everybody pretty much get it?
Well, they did agree that the students needed it, but I think that they struggled with the fact that maybe they had to role model some of it. So there were some employees way back then that felt that this wasn't right for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But so a very small, three or four people maybe, that, you know, felt that, okay, now we're all being held accountable to a certain standard. And, you know, that's something hard for people to agree to. In today's society, it's much easier to educate people on, because I think everyone is in agreement that we're a very polarized society and that this is very helpful.
Okay. So then once you get the staff on board, then how did you approach getting the kids on board and teaching it to them?
Through fun activities.
Uh-huh. So mm-hmm. fun activities like you mentioned a couple before, movies and things, skits and things like that, some other things?
Yeah, we would have the staff do things, catching someone doing something kind to someone, and then the students would have to participate in appreciating a staff member who helped them with something. So we started very small, and we worked it into song and dance, because we use a great deal of performing arts in our environment. So they created songs, they created poems, we had performances, and we all had a great time with it.
Okay, and so when do you feel like you'd pretty much got it going through this transition? How long did it take to before you felt like we're pretty much everybody's on board?
Probably very quickly, in the probably the first month or so, because it was very exciting. I think the downside is when it becomes operationalized and it is the everyday expectation. Oftentimes now, almost 20 years later, we have to remind ourselves that that's who we are. It's pretty much infused in our everyday life, but often with the students, we may have to say, okay, is that the kind of good character that we're trying to develop here today? And they are like, oh, yes, that's right.
A little bit like, sounds a little bit like what I hear in organizations, mission drift. It gets
there, you go.
and they forget and need to be reminded. The therapeutic boarding school I worked in many years ago, it was a back to basics. Okay, remember what we're here for. Remember what we're supposed to do. We've been sliding a little bit. At least that was the staff. The kids, of course.
It's still the same.
Yeah, I imagine so. Okay, well, so what are the future? Is there any modification or changes that are happening as our society changes, or have you pretty much got the formula?
Well, we have the formula for that, but I think just like anything else, there's an opportunity for modifications and improvements. I don't think that... I think we have to always keep it interesting for young people, and what we have done is we instituted a program called Quantum Learning, which brought in some outside professionals. It's a national organization. They do a lot of things for older high school students that may be heading into college on confidence building and things of that nature, but we really admired their program from the viewpoint of teaching teachers to be an active teacher. There's three kinds of learning. There's the visual learning, the auditory, and the kinesthetic. So we tried to, we trained everyone in the process about, you know, being a little corny, moving around the room, being physical, being a little bit more of a lively teacher. And everybody loved it. We did it with all of our faculty, both in the residential and boarding environment and in the academic environment, and everyone loves it. Sometimes our kids will break out into song, and these are high school kids, and it's kind of fun. The other thing that we did to also complement our school program was we did a very extensive training with, it's called the Hospitality Quotient. There's a famous restaurateur in New York that runs five or six restaurants, the most famous being the Shake Shack. But he has a whole management approach about how to work with not only your kids or your parents, but, you know, just with one another. And we learn things about charitable assumptions and when something goes wrong or something is late or we don't have something on time. Maybe there's a reason for that rather than having a reaction to that. And so that plays into all of the additions that we've kind of piled on, if you will, but you always need something new and refreshing and exciting to pair with what we already have.
Okay, well, we've about ran out of time, and this is just once over lightly on this character education. Maybe I can get you back sometime when we spend some more time in going into this. But this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, and it is October 29th. 2014, and been talking to Marianne Campbell. She's the executive director of Glen Home School in Connecticut. Thank you very much, Marianne.
Okay, interesting concepts. We've got a lot of questions here. Do you see all those questions that's mm-hmm. coming up, Liz?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the first one, how would you like it if they're teaching vowels and character you don't agree with? These are very expensive. These are generally desperate parents, and they are exclusively parent choice. That means the parents are taking care of the bill either by paying it themselves or by arranging and maybe getting insurance or something like that. If they don't like the values they teach, generally the values are things we all agree with, honesty and integrity and what have you, but if they don't like the values, they can take them out.
Well, and I think that most parents are very aware of where the kids are going, and so they would investigate that prior to having their child attend the school. So they usually are aware of what kind of values they'll be teaching once their child is there.
And it's not a situation, and I'm seeing some other things, some generally comments and lack of understanding about therapeutic boarding schools. It's not like the parents want to get rid of the kids. There are cheaper ways to do that if they really wanted to. It's that the parents are desperate. I remember when I first started, the parents would go on for hours telling about all the things they tried to do that didn't work with their kids. A kid was just obstinate, opinionated. Sometimes they had a mental health issue. Sometimes it was just very entitled. And all societies have had that back in colonial days. In England, they would send their kids out to the colonies or in India to straighten them up, especially if they had a bad time. They sent them that type of thing. So there's always been in a society some kids that just don't get it with the best parenting possible. And Glenn Holm works with the ones that are autistic, learning disabilities, things that they really need help with that they're probably not going to succeed at life if they don't get some good quality professional help.
Well, and, you know, one of the questions on here said, is this only for wealthy families? And, you know, there are a number of families that end up getting, you know, services that are funded through school districts, community mental health, and like you said, insurance. And so, you know, no, it's not only for those very wealthy parents. You know, when you say parent choice, Mark, it is by their decision. It's not that they've been court ordered into these programs, but the funding can come from a variety of sources.
Yeah, and we'll have a public service announcement in a few minutes. I want to answer this. How do you know what really goes on in those places? You visit. And a school, I will not refer a client to a school if the school doesn't let me, or let the parents take a full look, full run of the campus. And parents visit, educational consultants, picky educational consultants visit the place, have a pretty good idea of what's going on. And you hear about it from graduates, from parents that have had kids there. So it's not something hid back away. There are a few places like that, and that's the ones that we're all very critical of. We warn parents against them. So we have a pretty good idea what goes on in those places, and there are always visitors, always people coming to look, and people that are very, very critical and very astute. But so far as one of the options, we do have a public service announcement that's next for Saving Teens, Saving Teens Collaborative, is raising money to try to help parents that don't have the money but have the need in order to afford this.
Saving Teens in Crisis Collaborative is a nonprofit organization that was formed in April of 2004 when parents of struggling teens realized that the help they were able to access for their child would prove to be prohibitively expensive for other struggling families. Saving Teens' mission is to assist troubled teens and their families struggling with substance abuse and other emotional issues. We work with the therapeutic program industry to fund and support families with financial limitations as they complete the comprehensive program that they desperately need but may not be able to afford. In partnership with programs, educational consultants, and the family, Saving Teens establishes a payment plan for services that include scholarship, family contribution, and Saving Teens funds. Our goal is to provide a total solution to troubled teens and their families with a methodology that incorporates financial and emotional support throughout a 12 to 24 month process of evaluation, intervention, and education. To donate or to get more information, please visit us at our website, www.savingteens.org. Thank you.
And, you know, full disclosure, I'm actually on the committee this year to do the annual fundraising event that we do before our conference in February. And so Saving Teens really, really has helped out a lot of people. In fact, one of the women on our committee is also a benefactor of it, and her child has gotten some really significant assistance. So they're a wonderful organization.
Well, I'll say the same thing. I'm on the board and have been involved with helping them get involved, and they're expanding. And it's a possibility if somebody wants to know more about that, if they have a need and want to try to look at something like this, contact either Liz or myself, and we'd be glad to give you the information and the contact. Now, one question. Do you think they could set up the happy times when they know people are coming? It's awfully hard to do when somebody's coming almost every day. But Liz, do you want to talk about that? Because you
know,
deal with that.
You know, that is really difficult to do because, you know, it's really not possible, and you don't want to. You really want the family to see what really goes on. And, you know, sometimes you are dealing with some difficulties because that's why the kids are there, and that's okay to see. And so it's very difficult if you've got, I mean, I know, for example, I don't know how many Glenholm has, but I know that where you worked, Lon, at RMA with the vast number of kids, it would be very difficult to orchestrate them all to be happy at the same time. So I don't think it's really possible to set that up, nor do you want to, because that really doesn't give the family you really want them to be able to see what it's really like.
Yeah, that's very good. That's something that it's hard to do in a good program. Again, there are some programs out there that I'm aware of that would probably do that, and those are the ones I stay away with and warn parents against. Now, I sort of have a theme in this. We've been talking about some of the specialties of these various programs, like Hillary Cash and the digital addiction. Character education is very common, and a good example was that of Marianne Campbell. Now, there's a lot of philosophical ideas going on, and next clip is L.J. Mitchell. He's been around for a long time. He founded a very successful wilderness survival program, and he's now the president of Greenbrier Academy for Girls, and he's just written a book. It's available on Amazon.com called Good Life or Best Life, and he describes what he means by good life and what he means by the best life, and they're not the same thing, and there's a big difference in that. So let's listen to that clip, and then, Liz, we can talk about it.
Okay.
Welcome to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho. Welcome to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho. And we have today L.J. Mitchell. Now, L.J. Mitchell has founded several programs, and the most recent being the Greenbrier Academy in West Virginia. But he just has a book that he has published. It's on Amazon.com and other outlets. You can get it on Kindle or a print. It's called Decide Now, The Good Life or the Best Life. I've read the first part of it. It's very intriguing. And so what do you mean, LJ, by the good life, and what do you mean by the best life? Aren't they the same, or is there an important difference?
Well, there's an important difference. There's lots of ways you could approach this. What I've done is think about more of the proverbial good life, which is normally connected to feeling good, having a good time.
It's sort of a worldly thing, a man of the world.
Yeah, holistic approach to life, looking for self satisfaction, putting self first in most every context. And then the best life is sort of the opposite of that. It's the more altruistic perspective of looking at life as being a combination, a series of relationships, and how the quality of those relationships determine really our well-being.
Okay, as I was reading through it, I kept thinking, well, Joy, this is a more of a spiritual perspective. It's adding things that are unseen, otherworldly, I guess you'd say.
Well, I think what I've done in the book is through research and reporting several scientific findings, is to really look at what keeps people from really embracing the best life and a life of altruism. It's sort of intuitive to want to just feel good and want to do and get what you want out of life. It's not that, in some people's mind, rational to think about putting somebody else first or at least equal to self. So I examined some of the scientific pieces about that and sort of analyzed them to justify and reason that people can be very comfortable intellectually focusing on the best life and focus on a life of altruism, caring about others as much as self.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there, and you make a point in that in the early part of the book about the giving yourself permission to have a good life or a best life. The two are different, but there's this self-concept that is very, very powerful. We can't do anything that we don't see ourselves doing or have a self-concept of. Would I have that right?
Yes, that's a great point, Lon. One of the most difficult things in life is getting motivation and permission to do things. We often find ourselves, you know, pulling one way and another, sometimes three or four or five different ways, and to evaluate, you know, what that's all about, and look at the self, not so much as some inner thing that hides behind your liver, and that someday you're going to discover and it's going to solve all your problems, but define the self as something we are constantly creating, and that is a series of relationships that we have within ourselves and with other people. And the combination of those together in a context really is who we are.
So one part of that is that we really create, or through what we accept, our self-image, we really create who we are. It's our world.
That's right. And that's where the accountability comes in. If we have a very strong primary voice in being who we are, which includes our values and, again, the quality of our relationships, then, you know, we can hold ourselves accountable and others can hold us accountable. And that's where the spiritual piece comes in as well.
Okay, so, well, it sounds fascinating. We could go on all day, I think, and asking questions on that. But the perspective, how does this tie in with a lot of the research? And I see a lot of articles on empathy. Is empathy getting at something similar to what you're getting at in The Best Life?
Yes. From not having read the book, you're very insightful, Lon. Empathy is probably at the core of being able to live the best life, to know what to do in relationships that are going to be for the benefit of others as well as self requires empathy. We have to know what other people need, not just what they want, and what they overtly ask of us. And empathy is the real tool for being able to connect and respond in a quality way.
Okay, now I understand that you've been applying this philosophy with your school at the Greenbrier Academy back in West Virginia. Could you give me about a minute or two on how you're doing that and how you're helping the kids get this perspective and get control of their self-image?
Yes, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book is to explain the cultural model that we have at the Greenbrier Academy for Girls. Essentially, we have what's called the aspirations. And the aspirations are a series of five combinations of virtues. And girls have an opportunity to focus on one or two virtues at a time in the context of the school and how they get along with teachers, each other, their parents. And the whole objective is to say that our culture and our happiness comes from the quality of our relationships and how we value each other. And so we teach them not only how to do that, but we also try to find any blocks they might have unconsciously that don't give them the motivation or permission you were mentioning earlier that would allow them to embrace the best life. And some of that relates to trauma and addictions and all kinds of things.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. We've about run out of time, but stay tuned on my Tuesday noon Pacific time show. I have an hour-long program on K4HD.com, and LJ will be my guest then, and we'll go into this in much more detail and spend a whole hour, but now we've ran out of time. This is Lon Woodbury in North Idaho. Been talking to LJ Mitchell about Decide Now, the Good Life or the Best Life. Thank you very much, LJ.
Okay, well, that's very, very interesting, and we've already had that hour with LJ, so if you look back at about a week ago, they had a full hour where we talked about and developed these concepts in more detail. But this is an example of some of the things that's going on, interesting questions going on. Somebody mentioned about a youth correctional, and I think one of the things that people need to realize that a correctional facility is publicly funded. The parents have no choice in it. Oftentimes, those are juveniles that have been sentenced by a court, and a lot. When you're dealing with a public program, a parent doesn't have any say or much say about if they go, and it's a mixed bag. Some of them work fairly decent, and some of them are horrible. Most of the horror stories I hear about programs are public programs. Like, for example, boot camps are very popular, but the private sector, the private individuals, there was a few tragedies in the 80s, and there's almost no private boot camps anymore. Those are all publicly funded, generally federally funded. It came about from an initiative in the Clinton administration and funding to fund the boot camps run by the sheriff's departments. And it sounds like that's one that they're talking about. So in the comment, the show is about another type of program. It's not the kind of programs that we're talking about here that we've been talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So LJ's book, how long has it been out?
Oh, I think it just came out this last month or two. So if you get onto Amazon.com, that's where I've looked at it, and you can get the first 10% free from Amazon.com, and it explains the ideas on it. But if you just look at Decide Now, semicolon, The Good Life or the Versus the Best Life, I think is the full title. Mm-hmm. Or you put it L.J. Mitchell, and you can get a look at the book. It's very interesting. One of the things with LJ, he gets very deep into it, and so if you like to listen and read philosophical treatises, you'll love LJ, but otherwise it could be a little bit heavy. You have to work at it to really understand it, because he's getting so much into the basic philosophy. But that's another example. A lot of these programs, the good quality programs, the one we talk about and are in this network, are ones that have done a lot of thinking, a lot of creativity, a lot of originality in working with kids. And it's been very, very successful. It's enough so that parents will spend a lot of money. I've known parents that have mortgaged themselves up to the hilt in order to send their kids to get the opportunity to straighten them around. And because it's just horrendously expensive. I don't even want to go into that because people get sticker shock when they talk about it. But yeah, I found the LJ and his ideas, the more I read into it, it's intriguing. It's the basic idea is self-concept. What you think of yourself is what you are. Mm-hmm. But he takes it much further than that.
Yeah, he's pretty interesting. He's been around for a long time and has always kind of taken a more deeper look, I think, at some of the issues that the kids face and trying to find something that has a little more meaning for them. So, you know, I think that this definitely would be probably a good read. And I imagine that they're incorporating some of this at Greenbrier.
Oh yeah, very much so, because that's the whole basis of the philosophy that Ed Greenbrier is what he's doing on that, is that this is how you do it. He teaches the girls. They are very consciously making the decision, and I've heard a few conversations indicate to say, well, is that a good life decision or is that a best life decision? You know, getting it right down to that, to where the girls learn the basics of making that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really good to know, because I think that those are, you know, I think something like this really would speak to adolescent girls, especially considering that's a difficult time anyway.
You know, one of the basic questions, we don't talk about it, and it's almost illegal, at least there for a while, who am I, you know, getting into spiritual questions. Who am I? Why am I here? How did I come to be here? What's reality? All those kind of questions. Well, LJ's gone in discussing that, and it's converted it into a very specific program that has a good reputation and good results with kids. And you get a lot of that. And I think what a plus again. There's a big difference between private and public. Because public, sometimes they suffer from lack of low funding. You know, there's a budget cut or something like that. They suffer from many fingers in the pie. Some good, very good people work there, but they have to do what the boss, who's maybe some civil servant or politician, that says they have to do it. And a lot of those things go on. And like say my big thing is boot camps. Mm-hmm. The boot camps is something that it's plausible. A lot of people have the idea, well, those kids, if they're acting out, teach them a lesson. Be tough with them. Crack down on them. And these kids that are in these programs cannot process that. They cannot understand that they're cause and effect. That's one of the things they have to go to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like at Glenholm, those kids really can't understand that because they don't pick up social cues and bright. But because of the learning differences, processing speeds, or are autistic, high-functioning autistic, they just don't relate to that.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. That makes a lot of sense. And hey, we're down to the last minute here. And speaking of Glenholm, don't you have Marianne Campbell arranged to come on in the future?
Yes, I've got her coming up. She'll be talking a full hour about character education in the Glenholm model. I don't have it in front of me exactly when it is.
I think she's going to be on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, the 25th.
Okay, then hope those of you interested in that, come back and listen to that. We'll be talking with Mary Ann, and we'll have a full hour for her to explain her ideas and can go into a lot more detail.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's about it for today, actually, now that we're getting the sign that that's it.
Yep, that's about time. But yeah, wanted to do this. We'll do this every month or so. I'll talk about some of the news and some of the things that are going on. There's a tremendous amount, very original, very creative, going on in the private school sector of schools and programs for struggling teens. That's a term that I use. But this is Lon Woodbury, education consultant, normally in North Idaho, but currently this week in Orlando, Florida. And Liz?
And I'll see you later this week, Lon.
Okay, see you later this week, and be sure to come back next week when we'll have another show for you here on K4HD.com.